Dr. Penfield's geophysicist and vice president for African Latin American operations for Carson Aerogravity. He was involved in the gravitational surveys that discovered the Chicxulub crater. And those of you who've been following the activities in the whole area of the fossil record and such are perhaps aware that there has been some looking around for a number of years for a possible crater site that might account for the disappearance of dinosaurs and the deposit of a layer of iridium-enriched clay, I believe it is, between the Cretaceous and Tertiary periods. So Dr. Penfield is going to be speaking on this whole area. The abstract of his talk is given here in our program, The Idea of Extraterrestrial Impacts Producing Global Catastrophes. So this is back to the Bible, where the Day of Wrath opens with such an event. Dr. Harold Urey proposed comet collisions as a cause of mass extinctions in the geological records already back in the 60s and 70s. 1980, this hypothesis of worldwide climate catastrophe as the basis for extinction at the end of the Cretaceous period received some empirical support from this widespread observation of a boundary layer enriched in iridium of extraterrestrial origin. However, no suitable impact site was located among the world's known craters. Here, Dr. Penfield will tell us about the Chicxulub crater.
Well, certainly dinosaurs, meteorites, and things are on a lot of people's minds these days in the popular imagination. These are just a couple recent pieces of humor that you may have seen that I thought were amusing. Of course, more than that, the search for just as recently as this last September's issue of Astronomy Magazine had an article by 20 astronomers prognosticating what would be the leading issues in astronomy in 20 years from now, and one radio astronomer proposed that the whole issue of near-Earth or Earth-crossing asteroids, material that's in the solar system that possibly could collide with the Earth, would be the major topic in the year 2010. And we've seen even the government suggesting now NASA organizing a two-pronged program, one to develop a telescope network to observe these objects from, say, 50 meters in diameter and larger, and even Star Wars advocates saying, see, we were right all along to develop that system. This is a good use for all these nuclear warheads. Now that we don't need them anymore, we'll save a couple of them for when the day comes that one of these objects is predicted to collide with the Earth. Certainly mechanistic evolutionists have attributed this extinction of the dinosaurs to the whole rise of the mammals and say that if that hadn't happened, that we wouldn't be here. We'd still be running around little gerbil-like organisms or something running around. Of course, we know better, but it's given the possible influence of these bodies on life on Earth is certainly something that people are starting to reckon with now. Of course, no one's actually ever seen any dinosaurs or ever seen a major comet or meteor impact, and it just shows the power of ideas and the power of the unseen. We may, as soon as this next July, of course, have the opportunity to observe an impact as large as the Chicxulub one on the surface of Jupiter. There's a predicted collision now between a comet Shoemaker-Levy and Jupiter sometime in about the third week of July of next year. Which will be something of this magnitude. But let's imagine, if we would, for a moment, sometime in the early part of the next century, the news that a 10-kilometer cometic body is going to impact at perhaps 75,000 kilometers an hour with the Earth, potentially destroying a third of all life on Earth, something of the magnitude of what we attribute to the Chicxulub impact. And we can indeed see that it's going to be something that'll be more than front page headlines. And I think this is what I'd like to talk about today is the technology that we use to describe this crater, which is not visible on the surface, but which lies just a very short distance under the surface and is visible to modern geophysical instrumentation. And I think there's a particular sweetness message in this for Christians. I wasn't a Christian when I discovered this crater in 1978. In fact, I was a complete agnostic, about as close to an atheist as any honest scientist could get, certainly a very agnostic person, and just with the Lord's wonderful humor and irony to put those data, the first data that this crater was visible in, to put those in my hands at that time, and then to 15 years later bring me to the realization of faith in Jesus Christ, and then very quickly thereafter, within a few days, to show me those passages in the book of Revelation that to me very clearly indicate a role for a similar sort of cometic event in the coming history of the earth. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful, gracious thing, and maybe it will strike that pang of hope and that we all have, that the day of the return of our Lord is not far off. It has that special kind of meaning and suggestion for me to see some facts and things that I looked at for so long and not really to understand the significance of them until so much later. But I'd like to go over something of the science of geophysics that was behind the discovery of this crater. I think it's significant. You see, I've hung some maps on the side wall there. The spectacularly colored one is most of eastern North America and northwestern South America and the Caribbean. It's the compilation of the Society of Exploration Geophysicists of the Gravity Anomaly Map of North America, just published, I think, for the first time about 3 years ago in that form. And, of course, the Lord was looking at the Earth and seeing it that way from the time that he made it. This has all been here, and that's the beauty of it. It's been all there written, and just like so many messages written in nature, just cryptic, and for us to discover what was there all along. This is Pennsylvania is right here, and this blue area here is the Gettysburg-Newark Basin that we're located in here, this large gravity low. These are lows and highs in the Earth's gravity field, and the east coastal anomaly corresponding to the shelf edge of North America, Florida, the Bahamas, and some of the trenches indicating active plate interaction, these large gravity lows and highs associated with the lesser and the greater Antilles, and then the Yucatan platform and this little semicircular anomaly here that's visible, that's about 200 kilometers across, which is the one that's associated with the Chicxulub impact. But this is a technology that's primarily been developed as a result of exploration for oil and gas. It's been driven by that enormous engine and funded at a level of about the oil industry spends about $20 billion a year on upstream oil and gas exploration through the stage of, say, initial wildcat drilling. And it's been doing that for nigh on to three decades. And, of course, with that, you can do a lot of science and at the same time that you're doing all that drilling. And so there's that really the story goes back and is driven by discoveries from the oil industry. So I'd like to touch a little bit on the basic technology that we used, how it led to seeing this crater, and then perhaps go in a little bit into some of the geological controversy that arose with the interpretation of this body. I first described this set of anomalies as a crater in 1978 in a proprietary report to the Mexican National Oil Company. And this was 2 years before the Alvarez group at Berkeley described the iridium anomalies or even started looking for craters. After their work, a year after the Alvarez paper was published, I recognized that although the geologic authorities were saying that this, one, wasn't a crater, two, was the wrong age, that there couldn't be anything this large and this unique in the geological record that close to the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary without actually being the crater. And so in 81, we were permitted to just to show in a Society of Exploration Geophysicists convention, show some of the data. We weren't actually allowed to publish any of the hard data, but we were allowed to show transparencies and discuss the implications of this survey that had been done for the Mexican National Oil Company. Pretty much it slept then. I sent copies of that to Walter Alvarez at Berkeley and to some people at NASA. But it was fairly well established in the scientific literature, the idea that this was associated with some volcanic rocks that were already well known and described, and yes, maybe this made them a little bit more impressive or more circular, but that it was really something that was already accounted for. NASA's leading cratering experts looked at it and just sort of dismissed it as something that they already knew about, when really in doing the research, it was simply a case of scientists repeating what they so often accuse Christians of, repeating Holy Writ or something. This one Mexican scientist had reported that this was a volcanic feature, and they'd just gone in the literature, and everybody was just citing the previous author, all the way right up to NASA two and a half years ago, some of their leading cratering experts simply citing literature that had gone back to a description that was done about 30 years before. And the original samples that could prove what was going on there, the actual rock samples, had apparently been lost from the time that wells were drilled into the structure. So there wasn't really the hard evidence of shock mineralization and things to establish definitely that these geophysical features were related to the crater. Well, eventually we found about 3 years ago, we actually uncovered some of these samples that had been sitting in Tulane University for about 25 years in a closet. And indeed, when they were analyzed at Arizona, they showed that they had the definite characteristics of shock mineralization in the shore, quartz crystals. And subsequently now, this has kind of snowballed and became really confirmed, I think, in the eyes of almost everyone except a few outstanding skeptics last August with some definitive dating of both the samples from Chicxulub in Mexico and some other rocks from breccia, material thrown out of the crater from Haiti and northeastern Mexico. But let's take a look at what this technology is, what it means to be measuring the gravitational field of the Earth, which is really what that map is, a detailed view of the gravitational field of the Earth and of the magnetic field of the Earth. These two illustrations were from an excellent article in Astronomy Magazine. In the handout that I've given you a little bibliography of some of the key articles from our initial publication in 81 through the confirming article in Science Magazine of last August. And these are from Robert Dietz's article in Astronomy in July of 2 years ago, discussing just what Chicxulub looks like today and just how you go about hiding something that's 180 to 200 kilometers across. The crater would approximately be able to fit New York City in one side and Philadelphia in the other and all of New Jersey in the missing material. It's buried at a very shallow level, and yet except for it turns out that there is a very slight discernible physical sign on the surface, and in fact it was one known to Mayan Indian cultures there about 500 years ago, and that is the proximity of cenotes, which are the sacred wells that occur in the northern Yucatan platform that are the only source of water throughout the year. There's a preferential clustering of these wells all along the rim of where the crater is, and it even gave its name to a style of architecture, a pottery in the Mayan world. And we now know the reason for that anomalous ring of these cenotes is that they sit right over the edge of the crater. Much of what it looks like, this would be the crater just shortly after impact, about 64.6 million years ago. It excavated an instantaneous hole with an object of this size, about 10 kilometers across. It excavated an instantaneous hole of about 30 kilometers to 35 kilometers deep in the Earth's crust. We can see that from ballistic and scaling relationships of impacts. Of course, a hole that deep, 95,000 feet deep, can't be sustained in the crust, and so you had collapse of the sides of the hole very rapidly, and that's what you have, this faulting that's moved material from the sides in toward the center of the crater. You also excavated and vaporized an enormous amount of rock, perhaps 30,000 cubic kilometers of rock, enough to put billions and billions of tons of sulfur and nitrous oxides into the atmosphere. And then removing that much material, you had a rebound from the Earth's the upper portion of the mantle and the lower portion of the crust. And so much of what we see today, then after that time, you had simply the resuming. It was a very shallow sea before that occurred, and you simply had the deposition then of tertiary carbonate rocks on the surface, and now it's buried between about 400 meters and about 1,000 meters to the top of the edge of the craters. If Chicxulub were exposed on the surface, it would be the size of some of the larger lunar craters, something that would be quite easy to see from the distance of the Earth to the Moon. This is the technology that we little plugged locally. This is, I think it's an arm of Lake Nockamixon there, and this is taken right over this Souderton-Hatfield area. This is our two aircraft equipped for geophysical investigation. This one has this stinger here with a magnetometer, and it also has an airborne gravimeter on it. We're measuring the gravity and the magnetic fields of the Earth, not the gross, simplified sort of dipole field, but some of the details of the field. When you go down and fly or you move along on the ground with a magnetometer, you can find fired clay. You can find buried pipelines, and if you fly at the correct altitude with a magnetometer, you can find buried sedimentary basins, volcanoes, plutonic rocks, intrusions of that sort. So we put these instruments on various kinds of platforms, either these large Sikorsky helicopters that go very slow, or for faster regional surveys like this one done with a fixed-wing platform. This is what some of the instrumentation looks like actually in the aircraft. This is a Lacoste-Romberg gravity meter. You have a very precise mechanism, something, a very precise spring and a weight balanced on this spring, and you're measuring the gravitational attraction of the Earth by the acceleration produced on that weight. Really, in effect, what we're doing, if you've got a little bump like that in an airplane, you're looking at you've overcome the force of the gravitational attraction of the Earth for that one moment that you're weightless in your seat. That translates into about a million units of a milligal. And typically we try to produce maps from these instruments that are about one milligal in resolution. So we're flying in an aircraft so that it has to be quite stabilized. It's in a three-axis shell, and we have devices on each one of the axes to measure the kind of gross motion of the aircraft so that that can be removed, and you can look only at the accelerations that are occurring at this very small reference mass that's suspended on the spring there. Then the magnetometer is carried behind the aircraft. We're looking at the effect of the Earth's magnetic field on processing protons inside a liquid within the magnetometer. That's about, cost-wise, that equipment is about $750,000 for that instrument, and it has to get about $150,000 worth of maintenance every time we go out and do a survey with it, new accelerometers and things. So it's really the sort of thing that pretty much you need the oil industry to fund. We have a test range right here in Pennsylvania. Hatfield is, you have to excuse this map, it's oriented with north in the wrong direction. So Bethlehem is here, and this is the Center Valley area. This is Route 309. Sellersville's right there. And these red rocks are the ridges, the Penn Ridge, and the Jurassic intrusives that form some of the outstanding hills and topography that are around here. The blue rocks are the sedimentary rocks of the Newark-Gettysburg Basin, and then you have this thrust fault and the rocks of the Appalachians as you go into, drive into Allentown and you cross that South Mountain there. You're looking at some much older rocks, perhaps billion and a half year old Precambrian rocks that are thrust there. As we're flying along, we're measuring with this instrument at a fixed distance, either based on distance or time, usually on time, taking one measurements at 1 second increments, which translate into about 50 meters or so as you're flying in the aircraft. And we're producing a profile like this. After all the subtraction for the motion of the aircraft has occurred, we're coming to a profile like this. And it's from this profile we can determine some things about the geology of the area. We can see that we have highs in the Earth's gravity field associated with where we cross these massive, dense volcanic rocks. We have a nice low where we're flying over the sedimentary rocks of the Newark Basin, which may be 8 to 10 kilometers thick in this area. So you're looking at old lake beds, much like the sort of environment that we're deposited in the sort of environment that you have in East Africa today, the East African rifts. And then when we actually fly over some of that very hard, dense granitic outcrop, where we can see a very distinct little gravity anomaly there. As you get up into in front of the Poconos, you're looking again at massive thicknesses of sedimentary rock of a much older age, Paleozoic sedimentary rock. So we're looking at a great thickness of those. We take these profiles then and turn them into maps. The map, for instance, of all North America that we're looking at here. This is a map of a portion of West Africa that we recently flew on a contract for several oil companies. We're looking at a distance there of about 500 kilometers from north to south. And so we simply fly a large number of these lines. In the case of the Yucatan, we were flying lines 4 kilometers apart for a distance of about 500, 600 kilometers. And then you fly crossing lines and you map these values. Map these Z values of the gravity and the magnetic fields, and you end up with a map like this that's showing gravity lows and gravity highs that may be related to structures. This is and structures that are. This is a flat area now, unlike the area here in eastern Pennsylvania where we have a lot of outcropping geology. Here we're talking about a margin that's essentially just sort of flat jungle. And so what you're seeing are not effects of the presence of mountains or valleys on the surface. You're looking at the effects of the absence and the excess of mass underneath the Earth's surface. So we're really looking at a case like this where oil companies use this to shop for sedimentary basins, to look for areas where you've got lows in the gravity field that are indicative of large accumulations of low-density sedimentary rock that may be containing oil and so forth, and then perhaps for more subtle things like these little necks or noses that may be areas that would concentrate petroleum migration from some of these areas that would be, say, that we call oil kitchens. This just shows a typical survey, the way it's laid out, lines spaced every 2 or 4 kilometers, and then the compilation of a map thereafter. This is one that we flew in on the North Slope of Alaska. And this is what a major oil-bearing structure looks like. This is what all this controversy in the over the Anwar area, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is about. There's a structure here called the Marsh Creek Anticline. That's that little bow in the contours here, about 40 or 50 kilometers long, that is typical of major oil-producing structures elsewhere in the world. These kind of airborne technologies, along with satellite imagery, are used at the early stages of exploration because they're very inexpensive. The unit cost of doing something like this in an airplane is about $100 a kilometer to go out and fly and collect and make maps of these fields. So you can cover the whole Delaware Valley or the whole of Gabon or the whole of Mexico for reasonable costs. If you can maybe fly 10,000 kilometers, you're talking about $1 million worth of work. And if you go in on the ground in a place like Gabon and you start collecting detailed data, you may be paying $10 million for one well. And of course, ultimately, you really only know what's tapped by that 9-inch well bore. So you're trading information that doesn't have a lot of detail or specificity, but it's giving you information over a very large area inexpensively. The next stage in exploration, and what dominates about 90% of the spending of oil companies in the world, say of that $20 billion upstream, maybe about half of it goes for seismic exploration, where you're taking, it's an acoustic tool, where you're taking, we're looking at a section here now in time, you're looking at seconds of two-way travel time of reflections. We're not measuring a passive or potential field that's there all the time, like the gravity field or magnetic field of the Earth, but you're actively introducing an energy source, either using a natural energy source, say if you had earthquakes or if you had some source of vibrations, you could use that for a very shallow level of investigation or a very deep level. But typically for oil, you want a great deal of detail, and so you're producing a series of you're putting in energy in the form of either dynamite charges or of very powerful vibrations, or if you're doing this survey over water, of bubbles like a gun that's exploding in the water and producing explosions within the water column, bubbles, and sending acoustic energy into the earth, and then you're making an image of the reflections that are coming out. So it's 6 seconds, and typical speeds of sound in rocks. You're talking maybe about 8 to 10,000 feet per second. You're looking at about 30,000 feet down into the earth with this. And you're seeing a great deal more detail. Here's a magnetic profile over this same line, observed and computed. And we simply see that we have two anomalous areas where we have a low magnetic field. This computes, if we make some simple two-dimensional models, we compute that we've got two bodies there that look like this. And that's about what you can tell looking over a 15-kilometer line that's cost you about $1,500 to collect. And instead, if you go out, this is some offshore data, offshore Texas, if you go out and shoot 15 kilometers of seismic there, it will cost you about $2,000 a kilometer. So you've spent about $30,000 for this one line of data. And it's showing you a great deal more detail, but you can still see that it's confirming the presence to anomalous densities and susceptibility to rock body in the surface, but here you're using an inexpensive tool that's giving you just a sort of coarse picture of what's there. Here you're using something much more detailed that you can actually see. If you have a well to calibrate this, you know which rock units these particular reflections are from, and you can see that kind of stratigraphic layering that you would observe in the Grand Canyon. You can see it out here underneath the shelf of the Gulf of Mexico. So this is the dominant tool in oil exploration, is acquiring these kind of data, processing them, using wells and things to calibrate them, and then interpreting where you might want to drill around the edge of these salt features. And finally, this is an interpretation. This is one done from the sort of data that we use, a generalized kind of map that's showing depths in thousands of meters. We're looking at a fairly coarse sort of thing, going from sea level down to about 4,000 meters below the surface in offshore West Coast, and then looking at that with much more detail on a seismic section, which is showing an uplifted fault block, a downdropped area with sediments, and then some of the actual specific faulting that you can see there. So you wouldn't use this really to go out and drill a well on, but you might use it to select areas that you want to go out and do more detailed exploration with. So that's what we were doing in 1970, the period 1978 through 1981. I was just about 3 years out of college, and this was, I think, the second or third large job that I'd gone out on as a quality control geophysicist, basically looking at the quality of the data we were collecting and making sure that it met the specifications, and also doing some very elementary field interpretation of these data, QCing them, and also picking out some of the salient features in the data that might lead us to change the way that we were laying out this grid of the survey. So the company that I was with in Houston had, we'd signed a contract with the Mexican National Oil Company to go in and explore about 500,000 line kilometers in Mexico, to take some of the oil revenues they were getting from producing areas and explore large parts of the country that had never had any kind of exploration done to them whatsoever. So this was the very first mapping of some of these areas. And it's extraordinary to think, I mean, just how we are really living in the absolute golden age of scientific discovery now. I mean, it was one thing to find the North American continent, but I mean, once you found it, what do you do with it? Now we're really, really at the point where we're seeing what's going on and finding that there are, you know, incredible things that are going on. And I see that that's one of the exciting things that's kept me in exploration geophysics, is that you just find stuff that you're the first one to ever look at the data. And the first one really to see some of these things. And that was the case with this. We flew the entire offshore and the northern onshore portion of the Gulf of Mexico. And when we mapped some of these data, I made some rudimentary maps. I came up with a zone of anomalies of highs and lows in the Earth's field that looked like this. Actually, though, I noticed something strange even before doing that. We began flying in the offshore and just collecting these long traverses, and the next slides are some of the original data that I used in 78. They're kind of ugly old slides, but they're very, very dear to me. I can remember the day of unrolling. This is about a 300-kilometer long flight line, and observing, this is the excursions in the Earth's magnetic field that we see over it. These were the actual profiles that I observed that led me to the conclusion, line after line. This is one that's been folded over itself, so we're looking at the kind of symmetry that I was seeing in the Earth's field over a scale of about 150 kilometers. Smooth, gentle, long wavelength anomalies, features that are maybe have peak to trough distances of 20 kilometers or more, and then suddenly a very distinct zone of much shorter wavelength features indicating something shallow and magnetic, and then in the center, a zone where there's some truly enormous excursions in the Earth's magnetic field, and then on the opposite side, the same thing, a zone of smaller excursions. We characterize both gravity and magnetic anomalies by their amplitude, this vertical distance, and then by the wavelength, or the frequency, which is the peak-to-trough distance of the feature. So we can really see three different families. You see a long wavelength feature, which indicates that it's a source coming from great depth. You see some intermediate wavelengths of about the same amplitude, and then a zone of very high amplitude anomalies, also of these shorter wavelengths. And after putting a number of these profiles together, I just saw this extraordinary degree of symmetry where things were happening on opposite sides, 200 kilometers apart, very, very neatly, line after line like this. And I, the first 3 years that, first 2 years that I was doing this kind of interpretation, I spent that time primarily in Alaska, where there are large amounts of volcanic rock flying over the Aleutian Chain in western Alaska. I'd seen a lot of volcanoes magnetically, looking at the magnetic records of volcanoes, and never saw anything really like this that has this kind of degree of symmetry in the data. And what it suggested to me really was these are some solutions to possible source bodies for these anomalies. And what it, I guess the thing to get out of this really is that it's sort of like an upside-down volcano. You see the areas that are away from the center. Say if we take this as the center, and again this is about 300 kilometers across the whole slide, so about 150 kilometers. The actual the deepest parts seem to be associated with these very high amplitude anomalies, and then you get a shallower area associated with these peripheral features. And then again, extremely deep when you're off the edge of the body. So it's really just sort of the opposite of what you'd see if you were going over a volcanic complex, where you'd have extremely magnetic material at a shallow level, and then perhaps things derived, clastic material eroded and derived from that volcanic center. And it just happened one day. It was in April of 1978. I didn't have this analysis. I had simply the data profiles, and I just rolled out about a dozen of those profiles and then just looked at them and that symmetry, and it just came to me that this was what a large meteor crater probably would look like. And then I went to the geological literature. Take a look at the next slides. There are a few large craters on the Earth. Oh, let's see. These are the same data mapped out. There had been some land measurements made before we went in and did this airborne work. This was land measurements made in the 1950s. And they had described an area of high gravity here between the towns of Merida and Progreso and the Chicxulub area. And then this outer ring, which really no one made much of at that time. But the center area, on the basis of this high gravity, it was believed that there was a large positive structure there that would have possibly accumulated a lot of oil. So in 1951, 52, 1956, the National Oil Company of Mexico went in and drilled about four holes into the center of this. And they found volcanic, what appeared to be to the sedimentary geologists who typically work on the oil wells, just an igneous rock, something that looked like an andesite, like much of what the rest of Mexico is covered with. And so after drilling into several of these, they just sort of walked away from it and said, this is a volcanic area. And that was the beginning of that description. Here, if we put the magnetic data together with the gravity data, and these are onshore gravity data, these are the aeromagnetic data put together with it, you really get something that begins to look, even to the layperson, of indicative of symmetry on an extraordinary kind of scale, this concentric appearance. Very, very large magnetic anomalies here, the excursions in the field, very high amplitude. That's the highest magnetic anomaly on a coastline anywhere in North America. As it turns out, the birds have known that since the good Lord gave them away to decide whether they're going to come up the East Coast or go up the Central Flyway and so forth. This is a major place where bird migrations from Central America diverge at that anomaly and go either east or west and elsewhere. So there was some seismic data, these detailed kind of data, but typically they were very small lines. There was the absence of this large kind of synoptic view that you get from satellite or you get from an airborne data set. And so there was a lot of seismic data that had been collected here, but typically they were short lines like this, and they simply showed this discontinuity here. And it turns out, of course, that we're looking at this is 1 second time, so we're looking at maybe about 200 milliseconds of data, which indicates about 300 or 400 meters of relief on a surface underneath these young rocks. These are the reflections from the young flat-bedded rocks that have been laid down very recently, and then you get back into Mesozoic rocks. And then underneath, a very disordered kind of pattern. So it had simply been described as an area that was very bad to collect seismic data in. And in fact, there were maps showing this nice circular feature that was a bad data zone where the seismic couldn't be trusted. But actually, it was a case of really looking at this and seeing just too small a bit of it to recognize the whole structure. The Manicouagan crater, in the literature, it too had been described as a volcanic feature for many, many years of some Triassic age, 225 million year old volcanics sitting completely surrounded by billions of years, much, much older Precambrian gneisses and things of that sort. And there was never any evidence of volcanic structure, but until we really got back from the moon, it was really getting back, getting some of the moon rocks and looking at the melts that resulted from impacts and seeing the textures of some of the lunar rocks that we suddenly discovered that these things in hand sample look very much like a typical andesite. But when you look at the fine structure of them and look for evidence of shock mineralization, then you can really see that they are indeed melts, but they're not melts of a volcanic origin. They're melts resulting from a tremendous kind of impact. So I went and looked in some of the literature, and we've got, one of them has got a gravity field over this. Yeah. And this was about the best representation of a gravity field over a major impact. This is over the Manicouagan. There's a feature here of about a total of about 15 milligals. It shows a large gravity high, and then a gravity low over the center, and then some isolated anomalies, and then possibly something like a ring around the outer edge. But not really a very good representation, nothing like the kind of signal really that we're seeing at Chicxulub, nothing as distinct as that. Smaller craters, there are even more problems. Some of the smaller craters have a wide variety of different kinds of signatures, and nothing that was as elegant and large and symmetrical on the scale of what we're seeing at Chicxulub. So it was difficult to convince people just on the basis of these data that this was a crater. So the question immediately came. I went to, wrote these reports in 78 to the oil company after reading the science article in 1980 of Alvarez. I went to, sent a copy to Alvarez, called up some people at NASA. I went to see Dr. Bill Finney there, who was the NASA expert on the lunar melts, and said, yeah, all you would need is, maybe a cubic centimeter of this supposed andesite that was found in these four wells in order to do a determination of whether it was actually andesite or whether it was a melt rock. That's when I went back to the oil company and asked to see some of these samples or if we couldn't obtain some, and the report was that 2 years previously they'd had a fire where all the samples from the 1950s had been kept in Coatzacoalcos, Veracruz, and the whole bodega had burned down, and there was no record of the samples, just a big jumble of rocks with grass growing up in between them. So the entire sample library had purportedly been lost, and there was no way to really determine what had been done there. So the geophysical evidence didn't really seem sufficiently weighty, I think, to the community. This was a model of what the interpretation of those wells had been. They had gone down through this tertiary section, entered a zone of broken up rock or breccia, and then into andesite. And so it was interpreted as a peculiar kind of volcanic pile. This is from the original, I think, 1975 collection, the Geology of Mexico. This is the latest sort of reinterpretation done by Swisher and Alvarez in Science of August of last year. And it shows how the same facts can really get reworked in a completely different kind of way. Once you know what's there, it's easy to see the way the facts can conform. The key area of controversy was this pink unit here, the breccia, because this had been dated. There were fragments, unquestionably fragments of Cretaceous fossils within that breccia. And so the idea was, the experts at NASA said, well, okay, maybe this is a crater, but it's certainly not the KT crater, because you've got 200 meters of Cretaceous rock, which would translate into 20 million years worth of Cretaceous rock sitting on top of the melted igneous rock in the crater. So even if it is a crater, it's the wrong age. And that was the view of Sharpton and a number of others, even as recently as last spring's Lunar and Planetary Conference, that they maintained that this was a so-called Campanian age, about 80 million years old, and not a KT boundary. That subsequently has been changed because we've done some, or a group at Berkeley did some single crystal rubidium strontium dating, not just on fragments of the breccia, but on rocks from Haiti and from northern Mexico that were ejecta from the crater. They irradiated them at the same time, did the same analysis, and came up with the same age. But really, it was more than that. You could tell this logically that something wasn't right, because, of course, if you've extracted all this material, if you've taken out 30,000 cubic kilometers of material, made a 95,000-foot deep hole in the earth, essentially instantaneously, and then collapsed the sides in until you end up with a 200-kilometer-wide crater, clearly you're going to take a lot of the old adjoining country rock and bring that in. So that, to me, it never presented any problem mentally to think that you could have a few hundred meters of older Cretaceous rock sitting above this younger rock, sitting above the melt rock, simply as a result of the collapsing and the moving of large fault blocks into the crater. And although those rocks seem to be horizontal, they in the case of the measurements and the records, they might have very slight inclinations on them that wouldn't be noticeable in a sample that was just a few inches across. So it never really bothered me, and instead always I think I had the idea that even back in 1978, that even if there were 200 meters apparently of older rock, there clearly isn't any kind of iridium anomaly at 80 million years. There aren't two impacts separated by some distance in the rocks or some interval in time of, say, 20 million years or so. And so clearly, if there was something of this magnitude, a 200-kilometer crater, that anywhere near this age, it sort of had to be the one, like that saying from there's no other place anywhere near this place, anywhere like this place, so this must be the place. We have that in Texas. And gradually, I think now, as a result of this dating, of finding the evidence of the shock quartz, a lot of other things have come together. There were brecciated or broken up rocks that are found hundreds of kilometers away. What would be the effects of say, that impact that we were looking at briefly? And this is some recent work just this last spring from NASA of the kind of giant tsunamis. What would you expect if you took a 6-kilometer or the 10-kilometer object, excavated this very deep transient crater, you've thrown out an enormous amount of material into the atmosphere, probably enough to cover about 60 to 80% of the Earth's surface with a fine dust and ejecta from the crater. And you've also produced tsunamis, something on the order of maybe 100 to 150 meters high, that swept in, and indeed we find possibly a whole series of these tsunamis washing back and forth, say if this were the Yucatan and this is the Gulf Coast of Texas, 700 or 800 kilometers away. You've got a very distinct sequence that we would expect to see of reworked material. Looks something like that for these different locations, where you've ripped up material. In this case, you've got the previous bed of the ocean ripped up, and then you have material dropped out, including terrestrial material, commingled with some deep water sediments. So we do, in fact, see sections like this in Mexico, in Haiti, far away as Texas. Different now, the iridium in these layers lies right near the top, where you've had atmospheric fallout of these very, very fine particles that contain the iridium anomaly. But you have this much more violent depositional sequence going on underneath, and then the settling out of some of the fine material, and then your iridium anomalies in the upper portion of the section. This is the section in the Brazos River about 50 miles north of Houston. You can go and see this one of these sections preserved about a total of about a meter or so, and the iridium anomalous iridium concentrations up near the top of the section. Let me finish by saying this was all before I came to know the Lord, which was just a little over 2 years ago as a result of things that happened to me while on a project in West Africa, and its discovery, and in fact the PBS film and things were made just prior to my coming to know the Lord 2 years ago in Gabon. And then it was this wasn't a case of brilliant induction or powerful scientific thinking. It was simply being in the right place at the right time and being the first person to actually roll out those profiles with that kind of instrument and see what the Lord had put there all along for us to see, that there's this tremendous anomaly in the Earth's magnetic and gravity fields in that location. It happened to be that when I was a little boy, I was my first love was really astronomy, and I'd built been an amateur telescope maker and had a little Celestron telescope with me, took with me everywhere I go. And of course, seeing this symmetry, it suddenly I just looked at those records and said, it's a crater. But now I see really maybe more of the Lord's wisdom and leading in putting me in that particular spot, in that job, in Merida, in that hotel, in the spring to roll those things out and see it. Because within about 3 weeks of becoming a Christian in September of 1991, I started, of course, systematically reading the Bible, which I'd never touched before in 30 years, never gone to church, wouldn't have anything to do with Christians, wouldn't want to get near them, please. And so I said, well, I'm going to read this Bible now. And so I start at the beginning, dutifully, and then just in prayer one day, just very, very clearly, just said, you know, go and look in the book of Revelation. Go look in chapter 6 of the book of Revelation. All right, I'm just going to look what's in chapter 6 of the book of Revelation. I start reading, and I read two chapters, and then all of a sudden, I come to chapter 8 of Revelation. And I appreciate the comments of, was it Pastor Studemeyer? That there's something awful about, you know, finding predictions about Benito Mussolini and his mistresses somehow in the Bible, to go back in and read in these awful, trivial kind of current events into Scripture is just something that small-minded humans seem to have a real predilection to do. So I feel a revulsion toward that, and yet, as a three-week-old Christian, all of a sudden I read that eighth chapter of Revelation, and I just said, you know, just checked off one thing after the other that we know are associated with the effects of 10-kilometer comet strikes. And I just have to accept this is not the work of a biblical scholar by any means. It's an absolute neophyte leading of the Holy Spirit. Open your Bible and read it, and it's all there. And it really isn't a small or trivial sort of a political event at all. It's certainly something of a magnitude that would be sufficient to accomplish the kinds of things that occur in Revelation chapter 8. So I just lay out some of these effects of what would be. Maybe we could put that one project. Go back to the first slide on that side with that nice illustration of an impact. And I'll just leave you with some of these things that are most striking in my mind. I mean, we see what the precursor events would be. I'm running a little bit behind. Let me just briefly touch. I need to talk about the Earth crossing asteroids first, and just how all these things come together so beautifully. You know, in 1977, when Gene Shoemaker and his wife began a sky search for small Earth crossing objects, we knew of a total. This is the Earth, Mercury, Venus, Mars, and the orbits of about the 107 of the largest Earth-crossing objects. These are all objects that could potentially be colliding objects with the Earth at some point. This represents about 2% of what was known as of about 1980 or so. At that time, there were about 2,000. 1977, we knew about 2,000 of these objects. As a result of the Shoemaker's work, August of last year, they described the 5,000, and based on what they're seeing, they're predicting that by the year 2000, we'll have a list of about 10,000 potential impacting objects. I think their size cutoff is about, I think it's about 100 or 150 meters. Good size objects, enough to certainly take out all of New York City or something of that size, although not the size of a Chicxulub. So we're just finding out, like so much in science, as we get, so much of it, it's like the Lord just sort of revealing through the latest and best science just a little bit more and a little bit more of the plan to see a little bit more of that kind of detail. Here's something that people, human beings, have been blithely unaware of for 2,000 years, and these objects have just been going by, and really just like bullets shot at 50 to 75,000 kilometers an hour right past our ears. there was, I think it was January of 91, there was about a 15-meter size object that went within 170,000 kilometers of the Earth, and wasn't, which is, you know, inside the orbit of the Moon, which is really, that's a very near miss with a very big bullet. And that was only discovered on its way out on some photographs, and you computed the orbit and said, whew, that was close. And indeed, there have been a lot of these that have been really close. And I really wonder. I think it's a very interesting question about cratering flux, which is, you look at the cratered face of the Moon, you look at Mars, you look at Venus, and really wonder what is this actual cratering density and why there are so few of these things on the Earth. I mean, to the extent where geologists basically discounted them until seeing Chicxulub and seeing an object of that magnitude said, oh, you know, these things don't happen. They all burn up, or they were all gone in the early stage of the solar system. And I don't want to get into that. But there are a lot of these objects. There's going to be 10,000 of them described by the year 2000, according to Gene Shoemaker, who's making his retirement enjoyable by finding and describing these. So there are a lot of them out there. And any one of the larger ones are quite capable of eliminating the entire population of China or the United States in an impact. And we find a description, I think, that whatever spiritual meanings, you know, I don't know whether it's angel that falls to earth in Revelation chapter 9, verse 2, and opens up the key to the bottomless pit. I read some description of him as being the Pope or something like that. Maybe it is, but to my naive eye, I read this really very, very literally. I think the whole eighth chapter, we see at the end of the sixth chapter that the kings and the princes and everybody's panicking and hiding themselves under the ground, for the day of the Lord's wrath has come, and who's able to stand against it? And I think clearly, nuclear warheads notwithstanding, we'll see perhaps in our lifetime, I hope, the prediction of one of these large objects bearing down on us. And of course, there's going to be, I mean, I hope, not for the impact of the object, but because for what it signifies about the end of this stage of the drama on the earth and the coming of our Lord. Certainly panic, and then the beginning of the eighth chapter of Revelation begins with a description of ice and blood and the sort of material that you'd expect, organic material and slush that you'd expect in a cometic halo. And then you get this object which says was like a burning mountain, something like a mountain burning. Go to Revelation 8. And a second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. And indeed, that sort of mortality of about a third of living creatures is what we saw in the case of Chicxulub. We have a description of tsunamis and ground waves, and of course, we'd expect something about of a magnitude 11 earthquake, about 1,000 times greater than the largest earthquakes that the Earth has sustained to date. Tremendous blasts, maybe 6,000 times what we had at Mount St. Helens. Injection of all this rock material into the atmosphere, darkening, cooling of the Earth. Acidification of the water column, even when we read about the star being wormwood and turning a third of the waters to acid, and many men perishing from the waters. And of course, that's that acidification of the water column is what we see returning the waters bitter in the case of wormwood. In this case, acidifying the water column probably to a depth of about 75 meters, which accounted for the destruction of things like the chalk-forming coccolithophore fossils, the things that make up the White Cliffs of Dover that were doing so beautifully at the end of the Cretaceous, that you could get 800 or more feet of tiny shell material, of little creatures like that, built up into a chalk formation, and then they're gone. I mean, they're basically, you see a few little stringers of chalk from some high latitude, north and south latitude species, but the tropical coccolithophores are just about wiped out from this event. And of course, they're shallow water, and if indeed the acidification of the water column went to a pH 3, which is what some of the Australian researchers are saying, that's the sort of thing you'd expect. About 30% of the Earth, of living creatures on the Earth, wiped out as a result of that. And Yeah, there's just the NIV description of some of these events, and very, very, very striking. And then finally, in the beginning of the ninth chapter, something like a star fallen and the key to the bottomless pit, and smoke rising up out of the pit like a furnace and darkening the sun and the moon. So it's just a wonderful that sort of humor, and maybe the humor of the Lord, and something in His in my case, His divine grace and love to take someone as completely stupid and arrogant, and just hear no evil, or hear nothing about the Lord, see nothing about the Lord, speak nothing about the Lord, and with His tremendous grace, and to bring it around to the point that that 15 years later I can certainly see His hand in all of this. And I'm just so grateful that He gave me the opportunity to be the one to be there and first describe this crater. But clearly there's just so much. I mean, what makes, to me and to some of my friends who are of, say, a fundamentalist, we'll use that word, very shorter, fundamental sort of view of the thing, I say, you know, there's a wonderful concordance between the beauty and depth of creation that the modern tools of science and the scientific worldview give to us, that it just does honor to God once you understand that the beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord, and understanding that it proceeds from His design, and then science just fills in some of this beautiful, beautiful intricacy. And I was very much, you know, troubled and prayed a lot when some of my friends were saying, "Oh, you know, you're not listening you're not believing what's in the Bible, not believing Scripture." And I just fervently prayed about that. I said, "Lord, how does what I understand from geology fit with these words and Your words?" And it just came to me so beautifully. The last verse of the Gospel of John, which so many people just call hyperbole, and the Lord just gave me that verse and said, "That's it. It's right there." How many books did I write? It says, and if all the things that Jesus Christ had done were written down, even the world wouldn't be sufficient to contain the books. It's not hyperbole. And we do great injustice to the Lord when we say, "Oh, that's poetic hyperbole or poetic language." It's quite literally true for a scientist. If you were to really describe the wealth of creation and the wealth and the intricacy of design, there wouldn't be one more book like the Bible. It would not one more 2,000-page book. I mean, there's a whole book on the how He developed the digestive enzymes of the annelid worms. And you could write 800 pages on that. And we're just beginning to see science at this exciting point in the mid-20th century is just pulling back the veil ever so slightly to see these glorious intricacies and the richness of the design of Christ in the creation of the physical world. And if we ignore what science has to show, like that beautiful map there, I mean, that's all, the Lord put it all there. And it's to His glory that it's as perfectly constructed and as intricately woven together as it is. And I think it just does more honor and glory to Him that it's like that, and that we can appreciate and see a little bit of it. So I've gone over, and I'll just take any questions or...